Amnesty Talks, Amnesty Switzerland's human rights podcast. An episode in two parts on the war in Ukraine. The first interview is with Olha Martyniuk, a Ukrainian activist and historian. The second interview is with Lisa Salza, a campaigner at Amnesty Switzerland. Before we begin, I would like to give a short trigger warning. There can be mentions of violence, racism, queer and transphobia. Also, Olha will give us her point of view on the situation in Ukraine. The points may differ from Amnesty's position. In this podcast and at Amnesty in general, we want to take on a more intersectional approach. Thus, we will start by indicating at which intersections we find ourselves. My name is Suhini. I'm an intern in the activism team at Amnesty Switzerland. I'm a young, black, neuroatypical person. I benefit from privileges due to, for example, class privilege, having access to academia, and being able to vote. Hello, Olha, and welcome to our podcast, Amnesty Talks.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me.
It would be lovely if you would present yourself.
I'm Olha. I was born 1986 in Western Ukraine, in the lovely city of Lviv. I moved to the state's capital, Kiev, when I was 17. I was lucky and privileged to gain a good education at Kiev Mohyla Academy. I became a historian. Until now, I've been working quite a lot in history. I have defended my dissertation, and over 10 years I've been teaching history of Ukraine as well as history of science and technology at Kiev Polytechnic Institute. Being Ukrainian, who had lived most of my life in Ukraine, I have traveled around the world, and I have lived for 1 year or almost 1 year in Budapest, in Vienna. I lived in Washington, D.C. I lived in Basel, Switzerland last year. last but not least, I lived in Russia for 7 months, and since that time have many connections there.
You mentioned in our talk previously that you're an activist.
Yes, activism has been a part of my life, an important part of my life. I have taken part in the revolution of 2004 as an 18-year-old student in Ukraine, but I think I became an activist in 2010 when being a student in Budapest, I joined some protests against the commercialization of education in the European Union. This was only the beginning, because there in Budapest, me and a couple of my friends became all of a sudden sensitive to gender issues. And coming back to Ukraine, we have organized a small but strong feminist circle. We organized the first feminist marches in Ukraine, feminist festivals, and then this movement kept growing. I can well remember the first queer parades in Ukraine. I was part of it. It was not that much fun at the beginning, because we faced the police violence. But we were also young, creative. We played drums, and we probably launched a wave of gender activism and queer activism in Ukraine that one can still witness now.
Not probably, most definitely.
Not that it would not take place have I not been there. Of course, it's a global tendency. It's a global trend. And many, many more people start questioning the existing gender norms.
Exactly.
But it does matter if there are local activists and local activist groups. In this way, this wave becomes more powerful, and this debate becomes broader. And now, after 10 years, I can see that we started from very little things, and we had to prove our friends very basic things, and now hardly anyone questions some basic statements that we made back then in 2012.
I'm really glad that you mentioned the aspect of gender and queerness, because these are intersections that are facing a lot of discrimination. I would like to take a moment to ask, how are you in the moment right now with these last few days, if you feel comfortable touching on that subject?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was my plan to come to Basel because my partner lives here, and last year we had a lovely year together, and since then he visited me twice in Ukraine, and this was my turn to come to Basel. I had my backpack ready, and when I heard the first explosions near my building, I basically had a place to go, and I did that immediately, although I had some doubts, because everyone who lives has to solve a terrible dilemma, whether you stay and fight or resist. And by that I mean sometimes just carrying your normal activities, working or volunteering or joining civil defense. So the dilemma is either stay and fight or leave and become safe, personally safe, but unable to help and to fight. I think that for me, this decision was easier than for many of my friends and relatives and students and colleagues, because, well, my partner lives here. I'm a historian, and I can work from pretty much anywhere. I cannot be really helpful in combat, because I'm really never learned it and do not feel myself physically fit. So I decided that I can be a lot more helpful when I'm abroad, when I can, when I'm safe. And so I made this decision, and I do feel safe. I feel lucky. I can sleep rather well. I can eat. But of course, I have a lot of fear for the people who stayed in Ukraine. And it's really horrifying to wake up and start reading the news. I really wish no one has to do it.
Yeah. You mentioned that you have the dilemma of coming to, for example, Switzerland and feeling more physically safe, but also having the dilemma of like leaving your friends and families behind and not being able to fight. Does that mean you have found like other ways that you try to cope with this dilemma, or try to fight and help from outside of Ukraine?
Yes, I think I found what to do, and I'm definitely very busy in Switzerland. I work nonstop, and I think that in this way I can cope with the trauma of war. I can also observe that other people who came to Switzerland and have nothing to do, they are feeling really helpless, unable to exercise any control of the situation, and they feel themselves really, really bad. This feeling of not being able to do anything about your life and the situation is indeed terrifying, but a feeling that I can do this, I can do that, provides a lot of comfort to and actually enables my brain and my psycho to work. Just after I crossed the border with Poland, I wrote to my international friends and I asked them specifically for two things. Mm-hmm. I asked them to share my contacts with the media and I asked them to donate to my private Olha's Friends Fund. Mm-hmm. And I've been dealing with these two tasks that I have immediately set for myself all these 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Being professional historian and a refugee from Ukraine and an activist, I could talk to a lot of media and explain different aspects of Ukrainian culture and politics, history, to tell my story, and I think that it helps in many ways. I can see that Switzerland is well aware that there are many atrocities taking place in Ukraine. Swiss people do not accept it as normal, and Swiss people, also West Europeans, are aware of the brutality taking place, mm-hmm. but they really don't know how is Ukraine different from Russia. Mm-hmm. They really don't fully understand that Ukrainians have their own distinct bright culture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that my task would be to spread knowledge and understanding about it. Otherwise, I keep in touch with my friends, colleagues, and students. And whenever I see that money can help, mm-hmm. Not really often money can help, mm-hmm. but I make some address money transfers to my contacts in Ukraine. And I tried to place, I actually did place my student at my colleague's place in Germany.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to just do what I can, settle my contacts and find places in Western Europe for them, mm-hmm. as well as just help them financially.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of things. And it leads me to my next question, which is, do you think there's a specific role for historians in times of war?
No, I do. No, I think that I never thought history would become useful at war. I mean, Ukraine is at war from 2014. And back then, I've been thinking a lot about history. I was writing on my dissertation. I wanted to research and explain Russian nationalism in Ukraine at the beginning of 20th century. Mm-hmm. I found it relevant, but I never felt like there's a need to deliver my knowledge in a very concise manner to particular audiences. Now, being abroad, I feel that this is very much needed. Moreover, I'm thinking about what kind of history have I been teaching to my students. Yeah. All these years, I had so many, I had almost or even more than 1,000 of undergraduate students. They come
in Ukraine.
Yes, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. They graduate their school. They have they know some basics in history. I did not teach to history majors. I taught I'm teaching at the technical university. Mm-hmm. And so they come to my classes, and whatever the question is, they would blame Russia and Kremlin for all possible problems there are. I thought that my task was to say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. let's take a more complex look at this situation. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know whether it was right or wrong. On the one hand, I do believe that an ability to think about history and historical circumstances from different standpoints is valuable. Mm-hmm. For these young minds. On the other hand, I think I just spent too little hours or too little minutes to discussing the violence that that was imposed on Ukrainian nation within the last centuries, absolutely coming from the Moscow and Kremlin.
An interesting look at like how your perception of the meaning of being an historian may have changed. Do you think it has merged with like your activist side? It's now like one, or
being an activist and being historian was already connected before the war, but for me it was a lot about diversity, about looking back at history and making different social and gender groups visible, to dismantle the patriarchal politics system. Mm-hmm. And at this point I'm a little frustrated because I really should have talked more about the atrocities and the violence coming from from our eastern neighbor. I think that history and culture makes us as a community. I can see that my efforts probably contributed to a rather strong feeling of unity in Ukraine. And I think that in the long term, a history, a culture are the most powerful weapons there are. Of course, when you are facing the immediate war, you put aside all your historical exercises and try doing more practical things.
Mm-hmm. So diving into what you have mentioned before, you said that if you had a time machine, you would maybe phrase or you would teach it a bit differently. So from a historical but also from a feminist point of view, what steps do you think are very important to consider leading up to this 24th of February?
If you think about the history of Ukrainian's independent state, which covers slightly more than 30 years, you can easily see two trends. Unlike other countries where politics is often divided on left and right, in Ukraine, this division is more of pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian. And it's been a long fight and it's been a long negotiation. Pro-Ukrainian activists have always advocated the pro-Western direction for Ukrainian development. Pro-Ukrainian activists always demanded more democracy, more liberalism. But of course the right-wing movements exist in Ukraine too. An important factor in these developments was the Russian gas and Russian oil, because Russia has always, I mean, for the last 30 years, Russia has traded oil and gas for politically beneficial decisions in Ukraine. That really does not say us anything about feminism and women. But I would this way I would describe the Ukrainian politics, mainstream politics within the last 30 years. So we've been fighting for gender equality and we've been negotiating our standards, but the war is a very, very powerful factor in defining the gender relations. It seems like the society suddenly got divided into men and women. Ukrainian men are called to army. Moreover, Ukrainian men are encouraged to join civil defense, and Ukrainian men in the age of 18 to 60 cannot leave the country. That has had a profound impact on gender relations. Many families had to split on train stations. It became almost a standard story that the dad stayed home while the mother with her children went abroad. Many people in Switzerland see it as if men stayed in Ukraine and women left. In fact, we have to really be more accurate in our description and in how we see each other. First of all, out of respect to many of my friends, mm-hmm. I should note that many women fight. Many women joined the army. Many women joined civil defense. Many of my friends, girlfriends, volunteer in different within different initiatives. And my female family doctor stayed in Kyiv because she believes she has to do a lot of papers now, including signing the confirmations of deaths and things like that. So it's not just men who are fighting. Mm-hmm. And this perspective may actually overshadow a lot of female activism, also a lot of female activism abroad. I am here in Switzerland. I'm safe, but I am fighting. I have never been working as much as I do now, and no one's really paying me. I consider myself to be part of that fight. And at the end, we never know what is most important long term. You know, talking about Ukrainian culture and defending our identity, or being there in the field. Of course, I'm very thankful to everyone who stayed in Ukraine and who risked their lives, but we should really not limit the fight and struggle to the military action. Mm-hmm. Moreover, I think it would be a good thing to criticize the state rules, and many people actually do that. Why did state decide that women can leave and while men can stay? Not all men are ready to fight. I have a younger brother, he's 22. Mm-hmm. He has never been in the army. He lives with his mother. He's a true IT nerd. Why would he have to go to the army or civil defense? He can be a lot more helpful also to the state if he does what he does. An army should be a choice. Our state acts in its traditional patriarchal manner, mm-hmm. dividing the population to men and women and deciding who is there to fight and who is there to be protected. So far, we are quite united, and I guess there's a lot of understanding in the society that we all are doing a little bit towards our victory and safety.
It's being divided into men and women, but we don't only have two genders. We have like a whole spectrum of gender, and that leaves out non-binary people, that leaves out genderqueer people, and leaves them unprotected. So how can we protect people that are not in the gender binary?
The NGOs and civil activists mm-hmm. are working quite well in Ukraine, and I think that over the last years these NGOs managed to establish many networks. One of them is called the Feminist Workshop. Right now, networks are really crucial for the survival, mm-hmm. because when people have to move and to share resources and to start whole new activities, networks is what helps. Mm-hmm. So I really hope, and I can see a lot of cooperation and self-support in these informal networks that had been established over the last years
mm-hmm.
to support queer people. And I know that there are some safe shelters in Western Ukraine organized in the past days. Mm-hmm. And I think that while the state cares nothing about queer people, the queer people themselves self-organize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as it has been for so many centuries. It's an important point that you touch on, because I'm thinking also on reports of, for example, trans women not being able to cross the border because of them not being recognized in their gender. From a historical lens, how do you perceive the response of the international community to this war in comparison to, for example, past or ongoing wars?
I benefit from international response, and I'm surprised to see that much support on an individual levels. I have never seen really big demos in the city of Basel as nowadays, and I'm really happy that many people provide a lot of support. And today my mother crossed the border and she said that she was astonished by how supportive the Polish volunteers were to her and her peers. So I think that Ukraine relies a lot on this international support. It's very controversial, but I am rather happy Ukraine can receive supplies to carry this war. I like that this time the financial sanctions are quite strong, and the Russian population feels these sanctions. Of course, it's also very controversial, because the sanctions would hit most vulnerable populations and people who already struggle financially. But I think that with this big support of Putin's war, it is a necessary step. I can see that Switzerland, for example, has a big financial power. I would really urge Western capitalist societies to not really think of immediate profit, but rather to think about long-term stability. I think that Switzerland should probably shift its policy of neutrality towards the policy human rights first, neutrality second. I can also observe some other trends. For example, I do benefit personally from a very warm welcome of Swiss people, and I'm likely to obtain a scholar at risk stipend and stay here for longer. I really appreciate it, because I have nowhere to go. My area is shelled during these days, and I have lost my income partially, most of it. So I really appreciate the opportunity of scholar at risk program. But let's be honest, the support coming to Ukrainians is so strong because the Swiss and Western European societies consider Ukrainians to be European and a little bit more like us, more like they are. And I think that there's a lot more support to Ukrainian refugees than there was to Syrian refugees from Syria and other countries. And I think this shows a little bit about the Western racism. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe the solution is just like making better conditions for all refugees.
What a statement, and also what a call out towards the Swiss government. Yes, the statement to prioritize human rights. To wrap it up, I would like to ask if you have any expectations specifically towards Amnesty International.
We are all waiting until Putin and Russian government would have to answer for the war crimes in the Court of Hague. I think this is very important, but I can also expect that Ukrainian and Russian and other actors can really violate human rights. And I really want the Amnesty International to actively monitor the situation and help establish certain facts, because very soon these facts would become critical in the public debate and in the way our country would deal with this war.
Thank you very much, Olha, for joining us on the podcast Amnesty Talks. We will now welcome Lisa Salsa for the second part of the episode. Lisa is a campaigner at Amnesty Switzerland and will talk about Amnesty's position on the war in Ukraine and our call to action. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you very much, Suhini, for having me here today. My name is Lisa Salsa. I'm a campaigner with Amnesty International since 2014. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm speaking from the perspective of a privileged woman in Switzerland, but I'm representing today Amnesty International.
So let's just already dive in with the situation on the ground. Could you please tell us more about what is the situation on the ground and how has Amnesty been monitoring it in Ukraine?
Yes, let me first start by saying that what we are seeing in Ukraine is really a human rights catastrophe. Amnesty has been able to document human rights violations of the international humanitarian law, for example, indiscriminate attacks against the civil population, against civilian objects such as schools, hospitals, etc. We have also documented violations at the border from people trying to flee from Ukraine. Let me maybe start by explaining that Amnesty International documents human rights violations in the context of this crisis with three teams. The first is a team that remotely documents violations on the ground. Mm-hmm. It's our crisis evidence lab. Then we have another team that has been deployed recently on the ground in Ukraine, which is documenting violations on the ground. And there's a third team, the refugee and migrants rights team, that document violations at the border.
And these have been implemented solely for Ukraine, or these are methods that have been employed before?
Yes, these are three teams which constitute the crisis teams. Mm-hmm. Within Amnesty, and they have been deployed for several crises. Okay. Such as Afghanistan, Syria, etc.
Yeah. You mentioned the Evidence Crisis Lab. What is it exactly?
The Crisis Evidence Lab team plays a vital role in remotely documenting human rights abuses and ensuring also that we receive accurate information from conflict areas, mm-hmm. particularly in an area such as Ukraine, where it is very dangerous at the moment for researchers to gather evidence, and also in a context where mis- and disinformation are very common. So since the Russian invasion, the Evidence Lab has been working to collecting audiovisual evidence from mm-hmm. Ukraine, which may, for example, contain evidence of violations of international humanitarian law, also called the laws of war. And these include indiscriminate attacks on civilian areas, as I have already mentioned mm-hmm. before. The Evidence Crisis Lab team has already verified approximately 10 attacks, indiscriminate attacks and use of so-called cluster bombs and cluster munitions, which also constitute crime of law. The evidence lab receives evidence from a number of sources, including eyewitnesses in Ukraine. This is what we call user-generated content. Mm-hmm. Then it applies tests to ensure that it is actually what it claims to be, such as confirming where the video or the photo was taken and who took it. And it does that by cross-checking it with satellite imagery and other publicly available information. The team has also an expertise on weapons, so they can also verify if the weapon that is used really is a weapon that has been used, for example, by Russian forces in the past. So these are the strategies the evidence lab uses to verify the information.
Especially in the digital age, it's really interesting and important to see how activism works also from the lab. And I wonder if there were also reports that monitored the situation at the border regarding ableism, regarding racism, also queerphobia.
First of all, it's very important to know that the number of people we see here fleeing from this conflict is really unprecedented within Europe since World War II. And the majority of the people fleeing from the war cross the border with Poland. And what we also document and see is that the big burden of people receiving at the border has been taken by volunteers. Actually, there are thousands of volunteers at the border. This openness has also been facilitated by the Polish government's much more open approach to people fleeing Ukraine, which contrasts a lot to the pushbacks and lockup policies which they have been applying to people fleeing other conflicts and, for example, entering Poland through Belarus. But the life-saving assistance that NGOs and volunteers are now providing to people fleeing Ukraine was previously obstructed and criminalized on the border with Belarus. So what we can see here is that the primary responsibility of assisting people fleeing Ukraine has largely fallen on like ordinary citizens, non-governmental organizations and municipalities. I mean, we very much welcome the work of these volunteers, but it's also problematic because we have, for example, we have documented how volunteers have struggled to register new arrivals. And it's also a fact that without formal procedures to register and track them, and especially also those who do not speak Polish or English, are potentially at risk of abuse by people or criminal gangs looking to exploit these chaotic situations. And there's also a risk of becoming a victim of trafficking in this situation where you don't really have a government control of people coming in and registering them. The research team has also documented discrimination at the border. For instance, as Ukraine's martial law prohibits men aged between 18 and 60 from leaving the country, people leaving Ukraine are overwhelmingly cis women and children as families are being separated. And these limitations have especially problematic effects on disabled men and men with the sole responsibility for their children. Amnesty has also spoken to 27 non-Ukrainian nationals who fled Ukraine following the Russian invasion, including many international students and people who had been living in Ukraine for up to 20 years. Racialized people, in particular Black people, reported suffering discrimination and violence by Ukrainian forces when trying to leave. Many of them reported discriminatory treatment both when trying to board trains or buses, but also near border checkpoints, while some also detailed physical and verbal aggressions by Ukraine forces and also by volunteers. So racialized people from a number of countries in Africa, the Middle East and South Asia recounted how Ukrainian forces and staff repeatedly prevented them from boarding trains towards Poland.
Mm-hmm.
They were told that there was a need to give priority to women and children, but African and South Asian women were reportedly also not allowed to board trains.
Yeah, it's really important point that you're referencing. One can see how war really enforces different discriminations that have been persistent, but like really highlights them. Again, you mentioned disability, you mentioned racism, you also mentioned transphobia. So yeah, it shows how research can aid in exposing these discriminations. So thank you for elaborating on that.
Maybe just one last point on the discrimination. Amnesty has so far not been able to document how the conflict affects the rights of LGBTIQ people in Ukraine, okay, as such. But we know that there have been problems, for example, for transgender people who tried to cross the border when their identification documents don't fit.
What are demands that Amnesty has regarding the war in Ukraine?
Well, as I have been saying before, the violations we have documented in Ukraine might amount to war crimes.
Mm.
And the people responsible for these war crimes need to be investigated and be held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
That's a call we have to the international community. We also call on UN member states to uphold and defend the UN Charter, which prohibits the use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. We also obviously have specific calls to Russia. We actually launched a petition,
okay,
calling on the Russian ambassador in Switzerland to use his influence on the Russian government to call upon them to stop the war immediately,
mm-hmm,
and namely to stop every indiscriminate attack or the use of cluster munition. And we also, because we document also a huge increase of the repression on people in Russia, people who protest against the war. So our third call to Russia is to stop this repression and to respect and protect freedom of expression and assembly.
You mentioned what actions Amnesty specifically is taking, and I think our listeners might be wondering what they as activists can do. Is there a call to action that they can support?
Yes, activists can still sign our petition to the Russian ambassador. But I think one thing that is really also important to show solidarity and to call upon the Swiss government to use every tool they have at hand to contribute to stop this war.
Mm-hmm.
So to this end, we are in a coalition with other organizations and political parties, organizing a national protest in Bern this 2nd of April,
okay,
1:30 in Bern. So we would call upon activists to participate, to, mm-hmm, join us in this protest.
Lisa, what are specific demands that Amnesty has regarding Switzerland?
With regards to refugees and migrants' rights, we call upon Switzerland to really welcome all people fleeing Ukraine without discrimination. And we would also hope for Switzerland to apply these very generous standards they are applying now to people fleeing from Ukraine, to people fleeing from other conflicts and threatening situations.
Mm-hmm.
We also ask Switzerland to grant international protection to the people who need it. I'm specifically thinking of journalists, human rights defenders, and other activists who are threatened in Russia and also Belarus. We shouldn't forget about Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
People who need to flee from repression and are looking for asylum.
Very important statement, which reminds me of what Olha said in her interview. She mentioned that she would wish for Switzerland to prioritize human rights. Thank you, Lisa, for being on our podcast, Amnesty Talks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening in on Amnesty Talks, and see you soon for a new episode. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and check out amnesty.ch for articles, reports, events, and for the membership form. Are you 26 years or younger? Then check out Amnesty Youth. You can find all links in the description.